Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow it just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Hello everyone out there, this is Doran Rosenfeld, your host, and I have a really exciting guest tonight who's going to talk about two of our favorite subjects, stress and anxiety. Our guest is Jason Gerardo. He's a life coach. His job is to assist you to discover your true path and support you in achieving your goals. Every person is unique, and during your first consultation, he works with you to discover what you would like to achieve. Then the two of you will discuss how it can best support the actualization of your goals. Jason's coaching is goal-oriented and collaborative. And in order to best achieve your goals, it is crucial to release the stress, anxiety, and frustration that comes up all around us. He has participated with a group called Veterans Path. It was previously Honoring the Path of the Warrior. This is a meditation and mindfulness-based organization based in San Francisco. There, Jason saw how this work could support those people with TBIs. Although he doesn't specifically work on those injuries, we all know that a common sequelae of brain injury is stress and anxiety. And by alleviating the stress and anxiety, you can live a happier and a healthier life. Jason wants to know if there is something you are working towards achieving that you see as being the end goal. It's important to ask yourself these questions. What is the purpose of having this goal? What will it do for me? How will I feel upon achieving it? And why is it important that I achieve this? He works with you throughout this process so you can identify your real goal, and then you are more empowered to achieve those goals. Finally, he wants to remind us that happiness is achievable, and it is an end unto itself. So I'd like to introduce tonight's guest, Mr. Jason Gerardo. Would you say hello to my audience, please?
Thank you, Doran. Hello, everybody. It's great to be here with you today. I'm really excited to be in this conversation.
Okay, so let's start out. Tell us about what you do, Jason.
Great. A little bit about me is, you know, I've always been into helping people. It's always been kind of a calling that I've had. So in about the year, about 2000, I really decided to do something about it and get some training. So I started my training in neurolinguistic programming, shorthanded NLP. And went from there. The funny thing is that part of my training was also involved hypnosis. And at the time, I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting, but we'll see. And then that ended up becoming one of my favorite things, is actually using hypnotic language and hypnosis with clients. So it's pretty exciting. But then I started learning and training there in about 2000. And then in 2010, I got certified. I went and spent about, I think it was 7 days with the training. And I got certified as a practitioner of neurolinguistics, hypnosis, and timeline therapy. And then I did it, used it at work, didn't really start seeing clients. And then in 2015, I actually got my master practitioner, which was about 17 days of training, a lot more in depth, and became a master practitioner at that time. And then right after that, I started seeing clients. I saw clients part-time for a while, about 7 years actually, and then last year I went full-time with my own business, seeing clients. I'm out here in Winters, California. Lovely, lovely place. My wife and I live out here with our two little kitties. And so I'm doing everything virtually right now. I have a home office, but I'm doing everything virtually right now. I'm also, as you'd mentioned, I work with Veterans Path. I'm also a Marine veteran and working with Veterans Path, learning some mindfulness and meditation, continuing on. I've been doing meditation, believe it or not, since I was 8 years old. I kind of stumbled across the box breathing method and started with that by myself. But that's a whole other thing where, you know, I'm also a meditation teacher. I'm doing an event, which I'll talk about later. So that's kind of in a nutshell where I'm at.
Okay. Sounds good. I can't wait talking to you because you know all these quote-unquote scientific areas that can actually help people. Right?
Yeah, I just recently, you know, I'm into a lot of different things, and I try to look at modalities that feed into each other, things that are, you know, that help and support each other, and into Huna, you know, Reiki, some other things, but this polyvagal theory, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, just came about, and it really just connects the dots. It really, you know, there's a lot of things, a lot of results I get with clients, a lot of positive things that come up, and it works. You know, that's how you explain it. It works. But,
you don't need
this
more
really,
than that.
Right. The result's there. You know, it's the old saying, the proof is in the pudding. But this is really allows me, the polyvagal theory really allows me to put the science behind it. And I have a friend that she does Reiki, and we were talking about like the chakras and stuff as well. And it just really brings a lot of things together. The one thing, you know, talking about stress and anxiety, though, that I wanted to mention first is one of my favorite quotes around it. And the quote is, if the problem can be solved, why worry? If the problem cannot be solved, worrying will do you no good. And that's Shanti Deva. And I always say it as, if the problem can be solved, why worry? If the problem cannot be solved, why worry? Right? There's no, it doesn't really do anything necessary for us.
You're right.
So, and we, you know, it's how we interpret the world around us. So, you know, if you don't mind, Dorna, just get right to it.
Okay, go for it, Jason. Enlighten us, please.
I don't know if it's going to be like that, but definitely. And I'm love to be with people, like-minded people, to have these conversations, you know. And I know I read a little bit about what your background is, and so I'm excited to be on here with you and to really share some ideas today. So, you know, starting
okay.
with just definitions. Anxiety, they say a feeling of worry, nervousness, or unease, typically about an imminent event or something with an uncertain outcome. And the thing about that is that, you know, an anxiety is an emotion of the future. You can't be anxious about something that has already happened. So if you think about,
that's true.
You know, if you have an emotion about, if there's an emotion about something that, if you're feeling anxiety from the past, there's another label for it. And, you know, is in the old terms, they used to say, you know, you name it to tame it. Kind of hokey, but if you put it, you know, language matters. I mean, that's what I do, neurolinguistics, right? So it's about language.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we look at anxiety, and it's not truly anxiety, but, you know, it is a big issue that we're all dealing with, especially in the world that we've had in the last 2 years and recently. But so, you know, it's good to be able to, and when I talk to clients sometimes and they say, oh, I have anxiety about the past, we kind of deep dive and have some, you know, we have a good conversation around it and find out maybe it's guilt or fear about what's going on, or they could be anxious about what's going to have an outcome that's based on that event. So that's definitely, you know, we can talk about that anxiety. And then there's, you know, stress, which the definition that I pulled out is a state of mental or emotional strain or tension resulting from adverse or very demanding circumstances. You know, the thing about stress is that, you know, stress can be good. You know, stress can be a motivator in the right amounts at the right time for the right event, in the right amount, of course.
When does that ever happen?
I'm glad you asked. That's something we're going to talk about tonight, about how we can look at it that way. But, you know, a little bit of stress is going to get you to, you know, do something. Like, a little bit of stress got me to make sure I went through my notes for today's talk and make sure I was ready, right? There's that certain amount of that, just that little, as we'll talk about in a minute, gets you to that sympathetic nervous system, like, uh-oh, you got to move. And that's what, you know, it can activate the sympathetic nervous system, which we commonly refer to as fight or flight, and support you in taking that action. But when we stress over something that we don't control and can't or don't do anything about it, then those stress chemicals can cause issues. Because there's a book, and I can't remember the author right now, it's a famous book, about where why zebras don't get ulcers. You know, these systems that we have in our bodies are millions of years old. And they were meant, you know, if that tiger was there, that lion was coming at you, you had to move. Well, we're not running into too many lions these days, are we? But that same system is there driving us. So that's part of the challenge, you know, and it's not the event, but it's how you respond to the event. That's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Quote. Something that I love. I love quotes. I just, you know, I take that knowledge and build on it, of course. Dr. Wayne Dyer is someone that I consider somewhat of a mentor. You know,
he's
an amazing man. And one of his famous sayings is, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And, you know, that's what it comes from. If you have an event in your life that you're looking at it as, oh, my God, this is a crazy event, that you're telling your body one story. But if you tell yourself, oh, well, okay, and easier said than done, I get that. I understand that we live in the real world. You know, some of this is academic, of course, and then we have to translate it to the real world. But, you know, but if we look at an event like, I'm in control, I'll take care of this, I can handle it, your body then is going to act in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just telling yourself a few little words can make all the difference in the world.
Yeah, just stopping and breathing, just taking that breath, you know, settling in. That's an amazing thing. And that's breath work I don't deal with specifically with breath work, but obviously through meditation, we do box breathing and we do talk about the breath, polyvagal theory, something. I didn't put it in today's because this is not a class in polyvagal theory. It's just kind of how it intertwines with what I do. But there's a thing called the vagal break, which it controls your heart rate. And breathing, actually, when you exhale, your heart rate slows down when you exhale. It goes slower than when you inhale. But we all, you know, our body has the autonomic nervous system, and the two main systems are the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system. And the way that I was trained, and this isn't a textbook definition, but the way I was trained, kind of the easiest way to remember it is the P and the S. So parasympathetic is like peace, and sympathetic is stress. That's how I always remembered it.
That's nice.
So the, you know, whatever helps us remember, right? But so there's those two pathways really in the autonomic nervous system. And in the parasympathetic system, there's two pathways. And one is the ventral vagal and one is the dorsal vagal. Talking about in the polyvagal theory, and we'll get to that in a minute as well, but, you know, we're always looking for safety. That's what our nervous system is doing. It's, you know, it's looking for what's going on outside. And safety is not a cognitive exercise. Safety is an autonomic experience, is what the quote is. So, you know, like we were talking earlier about, you could say something to yourself to help you calm down. And that works to an extent of maybe you have something that you've anchored a word that you've practiced in the past that helps you to get to that point. But there's a silly little saying. It's from a movie, and someone was stressed out and someone tells them to calm down, and someone says, never in the history of calming down has telling someone to calm down made him calm down. So,
very true.
But through, you can train yourself to where those are, you know, those are ways to anchor yourself to those thoughts as well. So with that, you know, we have to access the cues of safety as well as remove the cues of danger as our body interprets them, because just removing the cues of danger will not calm the autonomic nervous system. So just by getting away from danger, that's not going to necessarily, and when I say cues of danger, once again, as we talked about earlier, this system is based on the fact, you know, so the, well, I'll just jump right into it. So there's three, there's three parts to it, the polyvagal theory. One's hierarchy, one's neuroception, and one's co-regulation. So we talk about hierarchy, we're talking about the three types here of the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And in the parasympathetic, I mentioned the dorsal vagal, and also there's the ventral vagal in there. So dorsal vagal is our oldest system that we have in our bodies, and it's about 500 million years old. Dorsal vagal is the one where it's collapse, disappear, disengage, hide, save energy. So that's that system. Then after that came the sympathetic nervous system about 400 million years ago. That's the fight or flight. So that's as we evolved as species, that kicked in and the fight or flight showed up. And then there's the ventral vagal, which is about 200 million years old. That's the rest and digest. You know, that's when you're safe enough. That's when you can have connection with other people, and that's when you can create. You know, as our systems developed, connection was never a part of it until the ventral vagal showed up. And that's when we figured out, hey, being together is helpful. You know, what's the saying? If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. That's kind of where that comes from, you know, where we found out that connection with people is safe. And then we got into the tribes and things of that nature. So that's kind of the hierarchy where, and I think of it as, when I think of symbols of it, I envision the ventral vagal being like on your head up the top. And then the sympathetic nervous system being like in your middle, that's your chest. And then your dorsal vagal being like in your stomach and your lower, like your base, being down there as well. Because your dorsal vagal is actually, when it's, when everything's fine, it runs your digestion as well. That, and kind of jumping sideways, that's why when you get, as we call, quote unquote, stressed out, that's why your digestion tends to go haywire as well, because it wants to shut down. It just wants to hide energy. It wants to close down. It takes all of its energy to your core, and it doesn't work on that digestion. So, but, you know, the good thing is that, so there's ventral vagal, which I said like that. I think of that like as your, the top of your body, your head. When you're in ventral vagal, which is part of the parasympathetic dorsal. And I apologize if this is, you know, there's a lot of science around this. And like I said, this isn't a class on it, but just kind of figuring out how the body works. And just giving a little overview of these things for sure. And if you have any questions or any input, please, you know, let me know. And if there's anyone out there that wants to call in and ask a question, you know, that's, that would be great as well.
But, you know, eventually do that.
As I get a little sip there. So like ventral vagal, ventral vagal, you know, when you're in ventral vagal, you're able to see the bigger picture and options. Your nervous system is feeling safe enough and feeling connection. And it allows you to connect with other people and allows you to really control and what's called self-regulate. So you can really kind of control your status and where you're at. Homeostasis, as it's called, right? You could be at that balance. You tune into the moment. You tune out distraction. You know, you reach out for and to offer support. That's when you have compassion, where you're flexible and resilient. So you can see where, you know, really being in that ventral vagal state really helps. The other two, it's not we always want to be there because there's times when we need to be in the other two, for sure. But that's a place where when you're calm and relaxed and you're with people you trust and, you know, you're having a great day, most likely you're in ventrovagal. And it's not a bad place to be. You know, you don't find too much stress there, too much anxiety there.
Jason, can you stay there all the time, or is that not good?
You wouldn't want to, because if you were in, you know, if you were in ventral vagal, so, you know, the example of, like, person in floating in lukewarm water, and you're just, life's good, and I'm safe, and then that figurative lion comes after you, and you're like, oh, hey, it's a pretty little lion. How's that going to work out? Right?
You're right. Okay.
It's when that's a great question. You know, that does come up because it sounds amazing, right? It sounds like it sounds like I would never have a worry in the world, and I would be, you know, I would be at peace, and I'm enlightened, and I, you know, sit behind the Budai tree and have a great time.
Yeah.
In the modern world, though, there's definitely a place for the other ones too. And, you know, there's time for downtime as well. And, you know, that brings us to the sympathetic nervous system. And so one thing that I didn't mention earlier, is, and it's further down, but I wanted to mention it actually now because it's coming up, is one of the tenets of polyvagal theory is what's called neuroception. And that was, so Stephen Porges is the doctor that's been doing he's a scientist that's been doing the studies on this for a lot of years. I think the first paper came out in like 1994. And then Deb Dana, who's a therapist, she's really taken this information and she's translated it for those that are helping people, therapists, counselors, coaches, you know, anyone. And you've really, and with that, what you find is polyvagal informed therapy, basically. So he was looking at the fact that our autonomic nervous system is always kind of listening to the external world. And he termed that neuroception. It's always paying attention to what's going on. It's always looking for cues. It's always trying to see what's going on. Once again, is it safe enough? So the autonomic nervous system is listening. It's listening inside to what's happening with your internal organs. It's listening outside, scanning the environment for what is safe or a threat, and in between. And in between means people. And it reads other people. And believe it or not, that the studies show that we co-regulate with each other. Well, ideally, we co-regulate with each other to the point to where now that we are aware of this and we're aware that, you know, you ever walk into a room and you just, it didn't feel right? If something's up, something's going on, however you label it in your mind, but it's a feeling you get. Most likely someone or some people in that room are dysregulated.
Hmm.
And they're maybe in sympathetic nervous system because they're stressed out. Or maybe they're even dorsal vagal at that time because that's kind of where depression is dorsal vagal, and they're shut down. Your nervous system reads that as a threat. And so it's like, hey, something's going on. So, you know, intuition, there's a lot to intuition. And I'm a firm believer that there's more to it than just the polyvagal theory intuition. You know, you have certain things, but your nervous system is listening. And it's looking for those signals. And it picks up those signals. And so when you're with someone that you like and you're good friends with or someone you love and you're both in a good mood, you're co-regulating, and you're both feeding each other that. Now, when that other person is upset, your nervous system is reading that and like, uh-oh, danger, there's a threat. So that's something to be aware of as well. We regulate each other, and that comes back also to our childhood too. And if you grew up in a house that there was that it not regulated nervous systems, that could lead to issues for you later on in life because we're made to co-regulate. And I'll talk about that in a minute. I'm kind of jumping ahead there.
Yeah.
But the great thing about neuroception is that it reads all these signals. And so it scans the environment for what is safe or a threat, basically. I mean, our bodies are pretty much black and white. So it's like, what's safe, what's a threat, or what level are we at between? There's some gray at that point. It's sensing the connection to others' nervous systems. And it's very interesting to me, and this is kind of what ties into, I was thinking about for like TBI and different brain injuries, because if there's neurological damage or something like that, that could cause issues with the system, because our bodies are set up to read these signals. And so our middle ear and listens for the prosody, so the tone, the tenet and stuff like that of people's voice and the sound, it hears that when we're in ventral vagal. But if we go into sympathetic, it goes, look, your body now goes into threat mode, and it starts listening for sounds of threat. So predators, because remember, this is an old system, so it's listening for those low tones, listening for approaching predators, and it goes to high, looks for high tones, because it's looking for, once again, threats. So you don't hear. So if you're with somebody, and you're relaxed, and you're in ventral, and then something happens, and it pulls you into sympathetic, whatever it may be, you have trouble focusing on what the other person is saying. Have you ever noticed that? Where something happens and then someone keeps talking to you and you're like, I can't even, what was that? You know, you try to hear them, but you can't hear them.
Yeah, there's too much noise.
Exactly. And it's that focus. And so where your body focuses. Something that I thought was really interesting about this as well is when we look for others, we all have a natural head tilt. If you think about it, we tilt our head to a certain direction. When we're listening to someone, we nod our head. And, you know, there's our body language. So our neuroception is actually watching when people, like, talk with their hands, and it's interpreting what do those motions mean. So if you come from a family that doesn't talk with their hands a lot, and you get out in the world and you have people that are, like myself, that like to talk with their hands and are a little animated, your neuroception is like, whoa, 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 what is this? And you might find yourself feeling threat. And it's weird. It's just, you know, in natural civilization, you're like, what do you mean someone's moving their hands excessively? But once again, the sympathetic nervous system is 400 million years old. So there's a lot going on.
Huh. Yeah.
You know, one little funny exercise I thought about is, if you ever want to see if this really works, the next time you talk to somebody, and you might want to let them know, because it will freak them out to an extent. It will send alarm bells with them. Keep your head square. Don't move your head, and continually keep eye contact with them, and they will get uncomfortable. They won't know why necessarily, but they might, if they're close friends, they might say, man, you're freaking me out. What are you doing? It's just
very
something that's ingrained in us. Yeah, it's just natural to us to really pay attention to that. And obviously then you want to get your back to your regular one and rebuild that, you know, co-regulate again. But something I wanted to mention also about co-regulation is that with clients, so they recommend, like, say before I see a client, if I've maybe had a rough afternoon and I'm running around and I've got things going on and I'm going to see a client, I need to make sure that I regulate myself before I get on the line with that client, because I could throw them off. Or at the very least, what you would do, and what's that?
Yeah, absolutely. I could see that. Yeah.
And at the very least, then you would have a conversation. You would say, you know what? And if they know the language already, you could say, hey, I'm feeling unsympathetic, whatever that name is. Or you could just say, you know, I'm a little off this afternoon. Maybe we can just sit here for a second and just kind of come into the room. And whatever language that works with your clients. You know, we all have different rapport with our clients. And you just say, you know, let's just come into the room together and let's just settle in. And, you know, you could do the same thing, too, if you know, with friends and family, and if you're out and about or someone comes over and you could tell that they're a little stressed out, you know, how that relationship looks, you'd say, hey, what's going on? What's up? And if they're oh, my God, I, you know, traffic and this and that, and hey, let's, why don't we just sit and just relax for a second? Let's just, you know, and whatever that relationship works. Obviously, if some people be open to it, some people, you might have to take a different tactic with them, but just sit for a second. Just kind of settle into the room and just relax. And then by you being calm, it'll pull them into into ventral vagal also. It'll calm them down as well because their system will say, oh, there's no threat here. It's okay. It's all right. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, like the first time you meet a client, the first time anybody meets anybody, people get nervous for that. You know, because you have no idea. You get anxious because you have no idea what's going to come of it.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the great things about NLP is that that's one of the first things they teach us is building rapport. So they teach us how to read signals like these signals right here. They teach us to look at skin tonus, you know, the color, just read the, kind of read the person looking at these things and then getting into rapport with them and settling in. So it's once again, this is something that I learned a long time ago, but now I see why. Now I see the science behind it. It's like, oh, well, that makes sense. You know, I'm looking at that. So then, you know, we're talking about ventral vagal, and that's that, you know, the world is safe enough. I have compassion. I'm open. I'm listening. I can co-regulate with people. And then there's the sympathetic nervous system, and that neuroception is danger. Whatever that looks like for you, your system is reading a signal that something's wrong. There's a threat. So you start to disconnect. And like I was saying, you listen for sounds of danger. And you close off to the ability to connect with others. Because the sympathetic nervous system is a fight or flight, and you're an individual at that point. Because, you know, that historic, that's the 400-million-year-old version, is like, you need to take care of this body and get out of here. Let's go. And it starts off, it might be just a sense of unease, and it could be then that you go alarmed and vigilant. And the story that that's telling is that it's an unsafe world of people. So when you get into sympathetic, it's hard to be like, oh, you're fine, it's okay, it was just a backfire. Let's say the car backfires and you go into sympathetic because that's something for you that raises that alarm for you. It might take you a minute to calm back down because even though you're like, oh, it was just a car, but you go into that system and, you know, there's aggression. It wants to escape. And the focus is on cues of danger. And unfortunately, the catch-22 here is then you also might miss or misread signs of safety when you're in sympathetic. So not only did you move into that place where, you know, this is stress, what we're talking about, right? So you might be missing that. You might miss, oh, no, it's okay, it's safe, because you're hypervigilant looking for the signs of danger. Does that sound like anything that you've ever come across in your life, right?
Oh, yeah. I think most of us have.
You know, you get into a place where you can't see the good. And, you know, that translates to a lot of different places in our life, too, where you can't see the good. But sticking with the stress on this one, it's just that natural system is like, no, listen, we're going to protect you. We need you to be able to look, you know, you're going to look at the danger, you know, and then as you settle down, and there's ways to, and it's the good part is that there's ways to work on this. That's the whole part about the polyvagal theory is that you recognize, you identify, and we'll get to this, and then how do we make this work to our benefit, and how do we change these responses? So, we have ventral vagal, sympathetic, and now dorsal vagal. And dorsal vagal, this is the oldest system. This one's the 500-million-year-old one. And dorsal vagal, when you think about dorsal vagal, the symbol that a lot of people would use is a like a turtle. you pull your head in, you duck down, and you just want to be, you shut down and you want to be safe. So that neuroception, so what your system, your autonomic nervous system is looking for is a life threat. Not just danger, but a life threat. This is when you go into sympathetic and you can't fight your way out and you can't get away. You end up going into dorsal. And this system is when you shut down. It was made historically to save resources. It pulls all that blood in, right, to save the organs. You just want to disappear. Mm-hmm. At this point, you might be numb, foggy, collapsed, disconnected, and just floating helpless. And safety and hope feel unreachable. It's kind of despair. So this is the place where that's at. So maybe if people go deep into depression, that's they're most likely going to be in. And this is not a diagnosis, obviously. This is just a something to think about, is that they might go into that dorsal place. And you might also, depression could also lead to sympathetic. That's the one thing that I was talking to someone about today, that depression is actually a stimulant, believe it or not. You would think that, well, you're depressed, right? But it's actually a stimulant. And if you remove that depression, that's usually when you get tired, when that depression goes away, because it was giving you that part of the sympathetic, because it's tied into the sympathetic nervous system. And it's that danger, 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 something's wrong. And it's pumping that, that cortisol and that adrenaline into your body.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
We talked about that, but let's take a second and let's really think about a time, ventral vagal. Let's go back, and think about ventral vagal, because we don't want to leave anyone in dorsal that's out there, right? That's listening to this. We want to leave you in a positive state. So let's think about, what's one of your favorite things? Being outdoors. I love nature. Being outdoors, being connected to other people. Feeling good about yourself, feeling good about the world. There's always going to be challenges, but like I said, feeling safe enough. Think about somewhere that you enjoy yourself, whether it's a theme park or driving your car or whatever it is for you that's going to get you to that ventral vagal. Let's think about some good stuff, right? Because that's where you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about that. So you always want to leave people with a positive state, right? Always leave them happy.
Something we want.
And so that's even a point about polyvagal theory, is that when you do exercises, you always want to end people in ventral, and you can see why. You don't want to leave people, and I'm very cognizant and aware of my language when I work with clients, because language matters. It's very important, and so we want to make sure
we don't give
people negative. And then in your line of work too, you want to keep people positive and keep them looking forward to how things are going to work and how they are going to turn out positively and how you can help them. So that's kind of the three, the ventral vagal, sympathetic, and dorsal vagal system. And you can see kind of how we run through those. And you run through those throughout your day. And it's just the key is, like you said, you're asking about staying in ventral. There's a time and a place to do sympathetic. Dorsal, there are times when you want to just kind of disconnect. Maybe I just need a moment. I just need a break, right? And you can disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And then so we talked about the neuroception, that your autonomic nervous system is always listening. And that's exciting to me. That's something to where the interesting thing is that so it's always listening, and it responds to the situation based on the history of where this comes from. These systems were built and designed to do something before they got to us, basically. So they're gonna respond to certain signals at a base level. However, how you really think about it is up to you.
Hmm.
So it sends these signals to the brain, and then your brain makes a story. which I think is very interesting. And that's what plugs into what I do and my work. You know, one thing I wanted to mention too, especially because of, I mentioned earlier a little bit about, you know, whether it's TBI or just a medical issue, but talking about your nervous system is always listening. So it's listening also inside. So think about if you have a medical issue, then your neuroception might be that of danger. You know, something's not right. And it can cause you to go into or hover into sympathetic nervous system. But you might not even be aware of it. You're not even, you're like, well, I don't see an external threat.
Right.
But your nervous system is listening inside.
Right.
And if something's wrong, it also wants to alert you, hey, something's going on here. So that's just something to consider about when you start thinking about if you have things that are going on in your life that have been around for a while that you have going on, that, you know, as we say in meditation, you could sit with that and just kind of think about how does that make me feel? How am I responding to that? And is that a necessary response? Is that needed response?
That is something you want to ask yourself. Because why do we want to spend time on things that aren't going to help us, aren't really necessary?
Exactly. Right. And it's like that's where a lot of times then we talked about, you know, we talk about stress, where stress comes from things that's like, you know, what we said in the beginning, Shantideva, why worry? But what do? We ruminate on it and we think about it. And, you know, it's been proven. You know, it's interesting that we're at the point now where, and we all have our belief systems, you know, we all believe what we believe, and I have my own, of course, and doing the work that I do, I see a lot of pretty amazing things working with clients, and it's pretty exciting to see the transformations that people make, and they do it. You know, I joke and they say, and I think you mentioned it in my bio, that I say I'm a tour guide. I'm just there to help people to get to where they're going. You know, they do all the work.
Yeah.
I don't do anything to anyone. You know, that's like hypnosis. So people are like, do it to me. You know, you're gonna hypnotize me and you're going to make me XYZ. And it's like, no, you do all the work.
But you have to know what work. I mean, you can help guide them to do the necessary things so they can make it work for themselves.
Completely. Yeah, it's generative. You know, it's called generative change, right? Where I support them to make the change. Like I said, a tour guide. I help them down that path. That's where do you want to go?
Yeah.
Let's make sure that is where you want to go, you know, and then help them down that path to get them to where they're going. And then teach them how to be their own tour guide and to help themselves keep going. Something about, you know, like neuroception again, you know, our system listening outside, it creates habitual patterns of connection or protection over time. And your internal radar is calibrated to respond in particular ways. So, you know, you ask yourself, like we were just saying, you know, what story are you telling yourself? What story are you telling? You know, a little exercise that here for people that are listening. You know, think about what we've been talking about and thinking about your personal neuroception cues. So think about, what is a cue of safety or unsafety inside your body? So when you think about it in your everyday life, you know, what's something that you think about, but to you is a cue, something that shows you a sign that there's safety or unsafe inside your body. You know, some people might have a sharp pain and be like, sharp pain. And some might be like, sharp pain, I've got to go to the hospital, right?
So
we all have those cues. And then think about, so what is a cue of safety or threat from your environment? So as you go through your day, what is something that comes up that, you know, that tells you that you're safe? What's something external from your environment that lets you know you're safe? And that could be a lot of different things to each and every one of us. From the environment, you know, and then what's a threat? What do you consider a threat in your environment? And, you know, that's got a lot of different degrees there too. And someone, you know, the example that I use when we talk about, so there's a thing in neurolinguistics where when a client comes to me with an issue, there's a surface structure and there's a deep structure. So surface structure is what we would call the presenting problem, right? The deep structure is where that comes from. So same thing with language. So language has surface structure and a deep structure. So if I say like the word dog, someone that grew up around dogs and loves dogs and you know, lives with six dogs and everything like that, I say dog, and they have a mental picture of something happy and fun and play, and they have all these fun stuff. If someone maybe had a negative experience around a dog, maybe even when they were little and don't even remember it, but it stayed with them, when you say dog, they might have a different opinion or a different vision that comes to mind, so to speak.
Yeah.
So once again, cues of safety or cues of threat from the environment, and that's different for all of us. And then ask yourself, what is a cue of safety or threat from another person? So how do you know someone is safe, and or how do you envision someone's a threat? You know, situational awareness. I'm also I've been in martial arts since I was a little guy too, and the best thing, you know, I was in a conversation with someone the other day, and it's like, the best thing you could teach anybody about personal safety is awareness, situational awareness. Know your environment, be aware of your environment, and know when it's time to go. And trust yourself. You know, that's so what is a cue of safety or threat from another person? And there's some people out there that, you know, might think someone's just the nicest person and then they might be not a great person. Or they might feel threat from a lot of people. And people are just going about their everyday business. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of history that goes into that that builds that. So that's, once again, what's the story you're telling yourself? So that's just a quick little thing to think about neuroception. Kind of look at where you're starting from, you know, where in your body. And, you know, if you're finding a lot more cues of threat than safety, that's something to be aware of. If you see nothing but cues of safety and no threat, that would also be something to where there's something to learn there as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So basically, we all have to figure that out on our own.
Well, the good news is that, you know, if you work with someone like me that's trained in this, I work with clients to kind of go through. There's a lot of exercises. I actually, Deb Dana is an amazing therapist and an amazing writer, and she's done some great work. And there's a lot of exercises you do. You know, there's one of the main ones they do, and I, you know, it looks like we're going to have plenty of time tonight, is a personal profile map. That's something where you start. And what you do with this is you start with a client. And it's best if you work with somebody on this, just because, you know, they say physician, heal thyself. It's best to really work with somebody that can guide you through this, especially working with emotional stuff, because you don't want to get stuck. You know, I always tell people that, you know, I work with scripts. I work with exercises. I work with techniques. And that took training. But where my training truly comes in is when the technique doesn't work or if someone abreacts to something. That's where my training kicks in. You know, that's where you want to be with somebody who's qualified to help you. Because you can read a book and you could go through this stuff, but if you end up in a place where you don't want to be, you know, it's challenging. And like I was saying, you know, it's like, well, you know, one of the things you can get from a client if you tell them, oh, well, just don't think that way. You would never tell someone that, right? But if a book's like, oh, just think positive thoughts, you're like, well, if I could just think positive, you know, maybe someone would say, well, if I could just think positive thoughts, I would think positive thoughts, wouldn't I? You know, I don't want to be like him. So that's where you build the rapport, you help people out, you really, you know, when it's being compassionate, one of the main tenets of NLP is, you know, respect for the other person's model of the world. So, you know, as we're talking about this, where people are at is where they're at. And you have to respect that. And starting from there, you know what? That's your model. It may not be my model, but that's your model. Let's go from there. How are we going to get you the results you want, you know, based on that? That's just our starting point. So everyone's at where they're at. So, but it works. You definitely want to work with someone. In this personal profile map, what you would look at is what they do is you go through, and this is an exercise we're not going to do because it's a pen and paper exercise, and it really works better that way. But for people to acknowledge kind of where they're at, think about when you're in, as I said, we always start in sympathetic. So when you're in sympathetic nervous system, when you're in that fight or flight, answer these questions. When I'm in sympathetic, the world is X. And you would write down, the world is what to you when you're in sympathetic. And then you would say, when I'm in sympathetic nervous system, I am X. So I am nervous, I am anxious, I am excited, I am whatever. And you write those down. And then you go to dorsal vagal, and you say, when I'm in dorsal vagal, and whatever that, you know, people, as we actually do this with a client, we usually allow them to pick a word because, you know, it sounds very technical, and so people will name what dorsal is to them, whether it's collapse or whatever. And you would say, the world is, what is the world like to you when you're in dorsal? And I am, what are you like when you're in dorsal? And then the fun part is you go to ventral. And so ventral, once again, is what? Connected, safe enough, compassionate, ready to learn, you're curious, the world's a good place, I'm doing good. And you would say, the world is, and what is the world to you at that point? And I am, how are you when you're in ventral vagal, right? So that's the exercise that, like I said, you use a ladder for that, for the hierarchy, and you write it out. And it's a really fun exercise, too, because what we usually have people do is use colored pens. And whatever color, so when you're in ventral, what color is that? When you're in sympathetic, what color represents that? And you use a different color pen when you fill these papers out. And it's just a fun way to really look at, and, you know, when we write things out, there's usually some, you have some insight where you might not have before. There's that what we call the aha moment, right? When you work with clients and they're trying to figure things out and you're helping them down the path, and then you're doing the work, and then all of a sudden they have that moment where they realize something that they didn't see before. And that's a great moment, you know, because that's where the work begins, when you see what you weren't seeing before.
Very interesting, because I think we've all had aha moments and, you know, trying to figure out what they relate to, why you're having this feeling right now.
Exactly. Yeah, it's and that's when you just, as what I do, that's when I just sit and I just let them process. You know, that's a great moment. That's a great place to be. Let them process it. Let them get those feelings and just really feel it and be in that moment. And it's interesting because sometimes they'll be like, because I'm doing everything virtually now, they're like, are you still there? They thought they might lost the connection. I'm like, no, you know, I'm letting you process. I'm letting you just kind of be here in this moment now. Just let's sit with this and let's just figure it out, you know. Or not figure it out, but I just sit with this moment. So it's a good thing, you know. So there's a lot of exercises that we can do. And then there's, you know, the last part, the last part is co-regulation. And that's the biological imperative to be safe with others.
Mm-hmm.
Co-regulation is, you know, and this is co-regulation of our autonomic nervous systems. So this is connecting with others. The autonomic nervous system asks, if it is safe to connect with others. There's a balance between the drive to survive and the longing to connect. So your system is balancing that out. Even though it knows, you know, air quotes, that being together is part of survival and connecting, it still has to balance the two, because if it hits the fan, it's time to go, right? So there's a balance between that, between the drive to survive and the longing to connect. You know, and these drives can work as a team or they can oppose each other. So in an ideal situation, your nervous system can be trained and regulated to where it knows that it can do the both. Or unfortunately, if you're misregulated, it could oppose each other. It could see people, being with people, as being negative.
Oh,
and it's
going to
push
cool.
people away. Yeah. And, you know, one, I found this really interesting definition. I didn't write down who said it. It was a scientist. But he said he gave one definition of trauma as being chronic disruption of connectedness.
Yeah. That's very valuable, because people do feel that at times, and people don't know where to turn.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, trauma stories are carried in the states of autonomic dysregulation.
Yeah.
So if your nervous system accepted it, and that's kind of what happens with, like, PTSD, is that your nervous system ends up keeping you in sympathetic or dorsal, and you don't regulate, and you're not co-regulating either. So even if there's others around you that are in ventral and are calm and are there to support you and, you know, love you and care about you, your nervous system might just be stuck in a story of stress and dysregulation, meaning it's like, no, I can't see signs of safety, or I'm misreading the signs of safety. Our autonomic nervous system is also, you know, from the beginning, from when we're in our mother's womb, it's shaped and regulated through interactions with others. And so that's where, you know, if people have had rough childhoods and there was dysregulated nervous systems in their family, that's what they knew. That's what their nervous systems learned. And based on that, it might feed them a signal that people aren't safe. And so they self-regulate, because co-regulation is not safe to them. If there was childhood trauma. So what happens is then you become an adult that's used to self-regulating, that doesn't trust others. And that's when we have to do work to help them reshape that.
Mm-hmm.
And help them to learn.
Is that easy work to do?
Well, you know, and I'm going to talk about some ways that I work with clients that I actually, beyond polyvagal,
okay.
that I work with clients that helps with that. And it's you know, all this work is easy is a tough word. that's a challenging word.
Okay.
And I don't want to dismiss or diminish what people are going through, because it's not easy in the sense. There's things we can do. I've seen amazing results. But, you know, sometimes when – If we label things as like, oh, well, yeah, we can just get rid of that. Like we talked about in my bio, you know, everyone is different. Okay. And it's really about those meeting people, hearing what's going on, finding out the nuance of what's truly going on in their life. So that allows for us to see the path that they need to take, that they're going to take to get them to where they're going to be. There is a lot of stuff we can do. And I've seen amazing results in – you know, seeing clients for 7 years, I've seen some amazing results.
Wow, I'll bet.
So it is completely possible to help people. Now, once again, not here to treat, you know, to diagnose, treat, or cure. You know those words.
Oh, yeah. You gotta be careful.
And there are some And there are some situations that, you know, pharmaceuticals are needed and called for, and there's some things that there are some mental health issues that have to be seen by a certified therapist, and they have to be in therapy and deal with that. So I want to make that really clear too, is that this isn't, you know, well, I don't have to go and see my therapist anymore. I've heard about polyvagal. That is not the conversation at all.
Right.
You know, especially in your line of work, you know that that's, you're very clear with people. I mean, you're a doctor, but still, I have to be clear about what we can and can't do.
Oh, yeah, there's so many ways people understand the same thing. There's so many different ways to understand it.
And, you know, talking about dysregulation, you know, and earlier I had mentioned about with TBI or stuff that in that situation, because I was looking at some of the things that can come up with brain injury and TBI, and there was some stuff that, you know, you could see clearly that there could be issues with processing all the cues that you're getting too. You know, your eyes, you know, people talk about, you know, when I mentioned talk about, you know, eye contact, and I'm a little bit older, and I grew up with you always firm handshake and you always make eye contact with people. But actually looking away and then reestablishing eye contact is actually a way to regulate. Because when I was talking about the exercise earlier about keeping your head straight, not nodding your head, and keeping a straight gaze, if you don't look away and that's basically staring, right? It freaks people out. And that's because our nervous system is like, wait a minute, I'm now prey. This thing is staring at me too long. You know, just a quick little story. I have cats and I love cats. I love all animals, but you know, it's funny, just kind of ties in here.
Okay.
There's a little story that talks about how if you ever have people over at your house, like at a party, and people have cats, and people that love cats are like, oh, come here, kitty. And they're calling them and trying to get them. The cats never go to them. Who do they go to? They go to the person that doesn't like cats. So doesn't make eye contact and ignores them. You know why? Because cats see eye contact as being aggressive.
Oh.
And so if you don't make eye contact, because you're a predator, so they're still feeding off that natural thing. And so when you don't make eye contact, they're like, oh, you're safe. And they go to that person.
That's
anyway, just a little. Yeah. There's also how we hear. I talked about that earlier, about how our mid-ear hears that sound of voice and tone. And tells us that you're safe, takes cues of safety from you. And head movement, tilt, moving in and out of eye contact is regulating action, like I just said. The interesting thing to me is that if someone's voice is a cue of safety, like when you're in ventral and someone's talking to you and you're in ventral vagal, so your things, you know, the world's safe enough, then you take in information. If it's not a cue of safety, then you will not take in information because you're looking for cues of danger. So if someone has a voice that for some reason triggers in you a sign of being not safe, you won't take in information because you're looking for cues of danger. So this is just me. This is not Stephen Porges. This is not Deb Dana. This is just my interpretation. So think if you had a teacher that had a voice that for some reason just struck you off, you weren't learning as much because you weren't taking in information. You were looking at cues of danger. But then you have to, then you co-regulate and you settle in, right? That's something that, that you can do. Something to keep in mind is that, you know, there are three stories waiting to be heard inside of us at all times. There's a story based on ventral vagal, a story based on sympathetic nervous system, and a story based on dorsal vagal as well. You know, the stories that we listen to are the ones that are currently the most active. So when you think about it, so ventral is a story of connection, safety, and care. Sympathetic is a story of anxiety, anger, and action. And dorsal is a story of collapse and helplessness.
Mm-hmm.
So we we have those three stories going on at all times because those systems are with us at all times. And it's what story are you listening to? What are you hearing?
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, and that's what we'll talk about when I get, you know, it's like to what I do. But think about that, like what story you're listening to. And that's based on a lot of different things. And the story you're telling your brain is based on your conditioning and things of that nature. So here's a little exercise, a little fun. Think about it.
Okay.
So thinking about an event, think about not the worst event, just some event that you have that, you know, might be out there, and bringing perception, here's a little tongue twister, bring perception to the neuroception that was the starting point.
What?
So in this story that you're thinking about that you had, so what was the cue of safety or danger that you followed so downstream, let's call it, into the feeling, and then into the behavior, and then finally into the story? And what story did you tell yourself about this event? So think about something that happened, and think about kind of what was that first thing, what was that first cue of either safety or danger that started how you felt, how you behaved, and then finally, what story did you tell yourself about that event? And that's just a fun exercise that you can do. You know, you don't want to pick, obviously, a big thing in your life. You could pick something great. That would be even better, right? Picking a good memory. And especially, like I said, by yourself, you definitely want to try to keep it on the light side. So think about something that was a really good memory that you have. And think about what was that first cue that you followed into your feelings, behavior, and then the story you told. There's studies that have been done on people with PTSD over time. This was a military study they did with people that had dealt with things and trauma in the service. And a group of people that went through the same event. And it was a study done, so they kept in contact with everybody. And over years, they checked in. And they found that the people that told themselves the, let's call them, better stories,
did
better with dealing with it. The people that kept telling themselves the horrible stories and focused on all the bad and stuff, they were the ones that they found had the most trouble down the road.
Huh.
So the stories we tell ourselves is very important. And we live through these events, and we learn from these events, and then we can let go of the emotions and keep the learnings, you know, whatever they may be, but we can let go. And that's something that I work very, very closely with clients with. Keep in mind that, you know, the stories you inhibit begin far away from your thinking brain. So the stories you have come from the story that starts with your, you know, your neuroception. How did you read that situation, and where did you go from there?
Yes, because we can all read it differently. I was just reminded when I was talking to my husband earlier, and we were both telling somebody else's story, and we remembered the same thing that happened to us both differently. And I just thought that was interesting, you know?
Yeah, it's so true. It's that thing that, you know, one of the things I work with a lot in my work is the unconscious mind.
Yeah.
I have some information about the unconscious mind and how it works. And some people call it subconscious. In my little branch of NLP, we call it the unconscious mind. It's, you know, we kind of, anyway, that's just a label. Works in symbols. And it keeps symbols. That's why if you ever watch those crime shows, and which my wife and I do, you watch those, psychology is great on those, but you watch those crime shows, what happens when every one of the witnesses have the exact same story? They know it was made up because we all see things differently, to your point, because we remember in symbols. It doesn't remember words. And so if you use the exact same words to tell a story, that's not a true memory for the most part. I mean, obviously it could happen, but more than likely it's something that you rehearsed.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's kind of funny, but that's the way things were.
Unfortunately, Deb Dana, her husband, had a stroke, and she shares very openly about that situation and his recovery and how that worked. And she applies the polyvagal theory to it. And it's interesting because she's very, in telling of the story, it's like 100% technical as she tells the story. It's all very scientific and very fact-based from a polyvagal lens, as we call it. So it's interesting. But, you know, one of the things that I took from that story is that, you know, what feels dangerous what feels dangerous? And talking to her husband, you know, she was talking to her husband and she shared with it. And he said that, you know, one of his things was that he was at the mercy of other people's decisions, always having someone telling him what to do, when to do it, how to do it every minute of the day. And that was a cue of danger to him. His nervous system read that as a cue of danger. So as people have strokes and things in their life, you know, that does that. And someone in my life had a stroke, you know, and that's something that really, if I was thinking about, you know, and he's doing great, he's doing amazing, and it's his recovery is pretty spectacular. The thing is that, like, I know I worry when I get around. I want to make sure he's safe. And I'm like, and reading this, I was like, well, what I'm doing is I'm putting my nervous system into a state of sympathetic nervous system because I'm like, ooh, is he okay? Is something going to happen? And then what happens? Co-regulation. So his nervous system, neuroception, now reads that stress in me. And that's not the most helpful in this situation.
No.
Something that we have to think about too, is that, you know, we have to realize that we're bringing something to every room we walk into.
Yeah.
We're bringing our neuroception. We're bringing our nervous system as we walk in. So I thought that was very interesting, you know, that to keep that in mind too about, you know, and how he saw what was dangerous. This is something that if you find yourself having dysregulation and you find yourself maybe not having the best response to a situation, so this is more like on the stress and anxiety side of the house again. You're talking about that. If you find that you're stressed out, you know, I always use a silly little example, and it's older and it doesn't really pertain, because most people are like, what are you talking about? But it was kind of a common thing when I was younger. If you used to talk about, you know, there was always that joke, like, if someone you live with in the same house and they don't put the jar all the way back, I'm sorry, they put the lid back on the peanut butter jar, and then you go to get the peanut butter and the lid falls off, and someone freaks out and is like, oh my God, you never put the lid back on the peanut butter jar, and oh my goodness, you always do this. It didn't have anything to do with that peanut. It wasn't about that lid being on the peanut butter jar, right? There was something else that caused you to be stressed out.
That's so familiar in my house because I never managed to put lids on things. My husband gets so hyper. He grew up living in a trailer with his family. So he was always very conscious of where you put things and how you put them away. It just bothers me.
Exactly.
I don't.
So his might actually be tied into that, believe it or not.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's the first case I've heard where it's truly about the lid. But two questions that I really love that you can ask yourself. Well, two series of questions. So if you find yourself stressing about a situation and the level of your response may not be the level of response you want, because it's not about an inappropriate response. Because, you know, when you think about things and it's like, well, was that appropriate? That puts a lot of judgment on the situation.
Yeah.
And judgment never helps. Like I said before, respect the person's model of the world. So judgment doesn't help where you're at. It's not going to help the situation. So the first question that to ask is ask yourself is, if something happens and you don't like the level of response, the first one is this coming from what is happening now or a cue from the past that has come and grabbed me?
Yes. Important question.
Yeah, and just stopping, you know, just stopping and asking yourself that. You know, an interesting story is I do work with myself, of course, and I've seen the therapist, and I believe in it. You know, I think therapy is a great thing. Obviously, you know, I do coaching and I help people. I'd be a hypocrite not to say that. So, and I've done work on myself, of course, and I found one day it wasn't something that was obvious, but when like someone would be in traffic, when I'd be driving and someone would, you know, cut me off or do something, I found that I could find the words. I might say a curse word or two. I was in the Marine Corps, so I do know a couple of those. I might curse, but I could no longer find the feeling of anger inside. It wasn't there. I wasn't plugged into it. And if it was unsafe, if it was truly something unsafe, and then I found myself going into sympathetic, you know, then yes, then that's a fight or flight response. But just someone not being polite, not using a signal, you know, being, you know, I lived in San Francisco Peninsula for almost 20 years, but, you know, and I lived in LA too for a couple of years. So I've seen it all. But that's a great question. And this next one I love. I actually, you know, I love it because, and I think the way it rolls out, and plus just my doing hypnotic language and hypnosis, but I really love this. So if you find yourself having a reaction that's, you know, not the level that you wanted and might not be what you want to do, ask yourself this. In this moment, in this place, with this person or people, is this the response or level of response needed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty important. Pretty important question, because we all blow things out of proportion, see them from our own perspective.
Yeah, it really... Like I when I read that, I was like, oh my goodness. When I read it, I just feel myself like I'm walking down steps. Like I'm just slowly coming down and coming back into my body in a sense, you know?
Mhm.
And once again, I get that we live in a world that could be challenging. I get that there's a lot going on and there's this stuff out there, and so but this is a great place to aim for. And you know what? If you're like, in this moment, in this place, this person, this love response needed, you know, maybe if it comes from there the first time, the more you do it and the more you acknowledge it, kind of like that, you know, like CBT, you know,
mm-hmm.
It kind of works on that triangle and brings you down. That's something that you could work on and something you could have. And like,
uh-huh.
You know, so speaking of, you know, working with people, so, you know, there's passive pathways and there's active pathways. And so the passive pathways is what's going on in the background. It's the neuroception monitoring inside, outside, in between. And the active pathway is acting to consciously influence the autonomic nervous system. So that's therapy, doing processes, doing procedures, you know, doing these different exercises. That's the active pathways. And so to think is that, you know, regulation of the passive pathways is necessary to support the work of the active pathways.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to do things to work on your neuroception in order for the therapy to work. If you just go after the active pathways first, so if you just go into therapy, processes, procedures, and you don't acknowledge that neuroception, that you're responding, that your body's physically responding to something, you're fighting against the autonomic nervous system. And guess what? Your nervous system's going to win every time.
You're going to lose, yeah.
You know, it's anywhere from five, it's at the youngest, it's 200 million years old.
Wow.
So that's, you know, that's that system that's there. Now, how you see things, though, that is something that you can do. So the autonomic nervous system takes all of that neuroception, all that information, and then the brain makes the story. And by the brain making the story, we're talking about like the unconscious mind. So I'd like to talk about the unconscious mind, if that's okay.
Maybe I guess, yes. But I just want to say, wait a minute, before you start talking about it, I just want to say,
yep.
If any listener has a question, we mentioned call in, but just in case you're new and don't know how that works, you call in 424-243-9540, and then you press 1. And I'm here in the studio, and I'll see a big question mark by your number, and I will call on you. So that's how you ask a question. But Jason, please go on.
All right. And yes, feel free. Now, I am not the expert on polyvagal. You know, I've been studying it for a little bit now, and I've got some certifications, but I'll do my best to answer if there's any questions about that, or if you have questions about anything else I do or anything we talked about, please feel free to give us a ring, and I'd love to have a conversation. So a lot of the work that I do deals with the unconscious mind, and there's a little bit of a list here, but I do want to run through kind of what are some people call it unconscious, some people call it subconscious mind does. So it actually stores memories. It makes associations and learns quickly. So your unconscious mind is it likes to think like, oh, this is like that. You know, it puts things together. It learns very quickly. It organizes all of your memories. It will repress memories with unresolved negative emotions. It may keep the repressed emotions repressed for your protection. There's a thing called Huna from Hawaii. And they call it the little black bag. They say that you put those memories in that little black bag until you're ready to deal with them. And when you're ready to deal with them, then it opens that bag up. And it may not be when you mentally think you're ready to deal with them. You know, that's why sometimes, the theory is that's why sometimes things just show up on you and from your past that you haven't dealt with or you haven't processed, and they might just show up because your unconscious mind's like, you know what, things are going pretty good. Here you go. Here's something. I think you should work on this. And part of what I do is helping you to get to that little black bag too. Because it presents repressed memories for resolution. So it wants to make it rational and release the emotions around it. Your unconscious mind runs your body. You know, sometimes when I have this conversation with new clients and they're not really familiar with unconscious mind and stuff, I'm like, the example that I like to use is, well, who was breathing for you last night when you were sleeping? And who digests your food? And I think there's, and you would know this better than I, but there's over 100 muscles between your shoulder and your fingertips. There's over 100 muscles. When you go to move your, I'm moving my hand right now. When you go to move your hand, you don't think move muscle one, move muscle two, move, you know, you just flex your hand. Who's doing that, right? So it runs your body. And the great news is that it has a blueprint of perfect health. So it knows what perfect health looks like. It also, the unconscious mind preserves the body. It's the domain of emotions. It enjoys serving, but it needs clear orders to follow. You know, so they say that your unconscious mind is like a four-year-old child. So Talk to your unconscious mind like a four-year-old, like you would talk to a four-year-old child. Be compassionate, be loving, right? Because that's how you would talk to a four-year-old child if you wanted to get the best results. So that's the example that we use. It maintains instincts and it generates habits. You know, think about when you, if you drive, when you first started driving, you know, hands at 10 and 2, foot on this pedal, look at this, check the mirror, do this, do that. Now you're driving down the street, you're changing the music, and you're on, you know, you're looking at something, and you're driving, and you might be eating your lunch because you're in a hurry, and you've got one hand on the steering wheel, and you're having a conversation with the people in your car, and, you know, being safe, of course. Everyone's being safe and driving consciously. But you don't have to learn every time. You don't, like, that's how you know how to drive from, if you go to work, how to drive to work. You don't have to look at your GPS every day. Your conscious mind remembers that for you. You know, thinking about, like, when we used to have to remember phone numbers, right? Think about your phone number when you were a kid. You know, my mom's was 209-835-2612. Where was that before I just brought it up? And that number's long disconnected. So I don't know. Don't call it, because it's someone in Tracy, California would not be happy with me. But where was that number before I thought of it, right? It was in my unconscious mind. It was in there. So it keeps all that. It functions best as a whole integrated unit. So all of you, so being congruent in your thoughts, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, a part of me feels like this. Well, guess what? I have a solution for that. So in NLP, we have what's called a parts integration. There's another name for it from the original part of NLP, but we call it parts integration. And that's to let you see that you can be integrated. We talked about this earlier. It's symbolic. It uses in response to symbols. You know, there's ways to learn foreign languages. And one of the newer ones out there, it doesn't say like ball and then tell you the Spanish word for ball. It shows you a picture of a ball and tells you the Spanish word for a ball.
Oh.
Because your mind works in symbols. And it makes it easier. Your unconscious mind, here's one that's a big one. It takes everything personally. So when you if you're talking bad about somebody, your unconscious mind is listening. And it's like, oh, that must be me. It's always eavesdropping. So beyond just being kind, you know, always be kind, right? Just keep in mind that that's playing in your head too. It works on the principle of least effort. So it works on the path of least resistance. So it wants, we have strategies in our life, how we accomplish things, and it's looking for the path of least resistance. With that said, it also does not process negatives, which seems like it's processing a negative right there. But if I was to tell you, don't think of a blue tree, what's the first thing you have to do?
Think of a blue tree?
To not think of it. Some people say that, oh, well, you can do it if you're trained, all that. So let's just talk in general. In general, that's something that you have to do. You think of it first. So you want to think of when you think of your goals, you want to think of the positive goals. You focus on what you do want, not on what you don't want.
Right.
You get what you focus on. That's the big secret in this world. You get what you focus on. So
yes,
if you
the
keep
mind
telling
doesn't
your
own, know. Positive from negative. Just if you're focusing on it, it must be what you want.
Exactly. So focus on wanting, if you want money, if you want wealth, focus on wealth. Don't focus on not having wealth. Because if you focus on not having wealth, guess what's going to show up? not having wealth. So let's focus on good health. Let's focus on having the wealth that we want. Let's focus on, you know, where we want to be. And that's, you know, if you start that practice, things start showing up in your life. And it's very interesting. So things show up every day, right? So why not be the good stuff?
Yes. And what always strikes me is that you ask for things kind of, you know, not really paying attention. And then when they show up, you don't even realize that you're getting what you asked for because you've forgotten you asked for it.
Yeah. That's a great point. When it becomes that ingrained in you that you forget about it, that's when it shows up, right?
Yeah.
To the extent. When you just have that expectation, it shows up. You know, one of the things, not to be, this is actually the second quote from Wayne Dyer, but I consider him sort of a mentor when he was with us, and
yeah.
His books live on and stuff. He would say, set your intention and let the universe work out the details.
Huh. Yeah.
So, you know, pertaining to what we were just talking about, setting your intention is focus on what you want. Focus what you want. And of course, now don't get me wrong, as a coach, I work with clients that have goals, and we work on steps and goals and get them along their path. So there's that, you know, there's different levels. There's different ways to look at things. And if someone's going to a very specific goal, yes, having a strategy, having a path is the way to do it. You don't just go, oh, I want a car, and a car shows up in your driveway. You want, right? You want the car. You go down. You look at cars. You know, you get your financing in line. There's steps to do it. But, you know, hopefully people get what I'm trying to say. There's the metaphysical and there's the physical side. And the physical side is, yeah, you have to have steps to get what you want as well. So, you know, how does all this work? How do we do change? How do I help clients make change? You know, we're talking about that there's the neuroception and our body's reading these symbols and then these signs and then it's feeding a story to our brain. So where is that story coming from? Well, you know, one of the things I'm trained in is called timeline therapy. And timeline therapy is based on the fact that we organize our memories in a line, in a sort of a line. And I won't go through the whole timeline process with you today because it's a little complicated. It's easier if you have the drills. But basically, all of our memories are lined up. And everyone does it a little bit differently. And when I start working with a client, what I'll usually do is, can you think about memory from the past, point which direction that comes from, left, right, up, down, front to back, and then think about your future, something that's going to happen in the future, where does that memory come from, left, right, up or down, where does that come from, and then, you know, can you imagine that implies a line between your past and your future? But that's the technical side of it, and there's a little bit more to it, obviously. But what we do then is we find those first memories, what they call the gestalt, of, say, somebody has something in their life. Let's go back to the dog. And someone had a bad incident with a dog, and now they're afraid of dogs. So I would work with them to find that first memory. The first memory that, when released, will allow them to let go of that fear of the dog easily, completely and easily, and effortlessly. And we do work on that. So it's looking at where does these thoughts and emotions come from? And we can do it with negative emotions as well. What was the first negative time you encountered, let's say, anger? And we detach that first memory. We get the learnings from that because emotions from the past don't do us any good. There's no reason to hold on to emotions from the past. They actually found that holding on to emotions can hurt us. You know, anger can lead to heart attacks and the negative things, high blood pressure and stuff. So by letting go of the emotions on an event, but learning what you need to learn from that event, so if something comes up in the future, you'll know to look for it. And then we let go of anger and we let go from the past and stuff. So what that can do is the story you're telling yourself, if it's based on something from your past that's no longer relevant today, when you detach that and you allow things to realign themselves, now you're not going to tell yourself that story. And I'm simplifying it, of course, for conversational reasons.
Yes.
This isn't a class in timeline therapy, but that's the theory. And it's funny because when I work with clients, when they let go of emotions, this does happen really fast. It's a quick process. They usually have a little smile on their face. it's interesting because 99% of the time they'll get a little smile on their face, and you can just tell that a weight's been lifted, and it allows them to see a life without anger. Now, it doesn't turn you into a robot. You can still go outside and get pissed off. You can still get angry. It doesn't change that. But if there was something, like I was talking about my personal story about getting angry at, you know, people that cut you off in traffic and are rude in traffic, I let that go. And how I process things now is totally different.
That's probably smart.
Exactly. And, you know, stress, like we're talking about, where is stress coming from? And stress usually comes from you think you can't handle something. It's usually like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. And a lot of times it'll come from past experience that shows up in your life. And really, just really quick here, talking about, you know, to kind of get us on topic about stress and anxiety. Now, there's levels of anxiety, and there's people out there. I don't mean to diminish the people out there that deal with anxiety on a high level, because it's something that, you know, therapy and sometimes meds and, you know, pharmaceuticals and stuff like that are definitely called for. But something that works well with mild anxiety, mild to mid anxiety, is, so if you're anxious about, and we could just have a little fun little experiment here real quick. If you think about something that in the future, because once again, anxiety is about something in the future. If you think about something that you're anxious about, an event that's coming up, imagine yourself 15 minutes after the successful completion of that event.
Mm-hmm.
And then ask yourself, where's the anxiety now? And if it's mild anxiety, what's that?
It's gone.
Yeah. And if it's mild, it's gone.
Yeah.
So if you, and then if it's not, you know, and if it's mild and it's not, then I would say, are you imagining 15 minutes after the successful completion, envision the event's done and it's been successful and it comes out the way you wanted it to, and you can see yourself being happy with the outcome, and then
that's
ask yourself,
crazy.
What's the anxiety?
Yeah, that's a good exercise to keep handy, keep in mind, because, yeah, the successful completion, because then what's the cause for anxiety at all?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a fun one. That's a quick one. You know, it's when we do timeline and we go through the emotions, anxiety, it's like, let's just get this out of the way real quick. And like I said, not to diminish, there are people out there that are dealing with anxiety on a different level. And definitely they need to get the therapy, and like sometimes it's pharmaceuticals needed. It's dealing with other things. But just our everyday life, you know, I've helped people in my life. They were going to go into like a job interview or have an interview with somebody that worked, where they had to talk to an employee that was giving them some challenges. And they were a little bit stressed about it, had been a little anxious about it. And we did this exercise, and it helped them out, and they were able to go in just confident and sure. And you know, with the one that was for an interview, they nailed the interview and got the job. You know, it was pretty exciting.
All right.
They were qualified. Don't get me wrong. They were obviously qualified and a good candidate, but they were able to leave that behind and present themselves in the best way for that. There's something else called fast phobia model, which we do, and I won't go into depth on that, but it's for phobias. And, you know, we talked about the unconscious mind learns fast, and a phobia is usually a one-time learning, meaning one event happened in your life, and now that's how you feel about that event in any way. So an event about, if you have a phobia about, and I said I have to be careful about my language. So let's just say I don't want to have anybody have any issues with this. So if you have a phobia, what we do is we go to that first event and we do some NLP work to erase that, basically, to depotentialize is actually the technical term. We depotentialize that memory and it gets rid of the phobia. It was so NLP was designed mainly by two people. There was a whole, they were in Santa Cruz. They were at UC Santa Cruz, and one was a student and one was a professor, Richard Bandler, and was the main one. And Bandler was actually on, I forget the name of the show. It used to be Regis and Kathy Lee, and then it kept changing. But one of the hosts was an ex-football player, and the other person, I can't remember his, Michael something, I think is his name. I didn't watch the show. I saw this episode because the NLP was flagged. Richard Bandler was on the show, and one of the hosts had a phobia of snakes his whole life. And Richard worked with him for about 30 minutes. And before the end of the show, the host had – they had this big, I don't know, anaconda, whatever it was, one of those big snakes draped around his neck. And he was just talking and he was fine.
Wow.
So it does work. So the phobia model, the fast phobia model does work. It's pretty exciting. Something else that I work with is what's called submodalities. That's how you see your, so we code memories in our brain. We have a certain way that we store our memories, and we hear things, we see things. You know, there might be. So when you think of something like, do you like chocolate cake?
Yeah.
So when you think of chocolate cake in your, when you think exactly, when you think of chocolate cake in your head, do you have a picture?
Yeah.
Is it color or black and white?
I don't know. It's chocolate.
But are you seeing the picture in color or black and white?
Yeah, I think I am, but it's hard to tell because I guess we don't see a lot of memories of black and white. But anyway.
Right. So that's the interesting thing there. And submodalities work there's a fast way to use them. There's long-term procedures you can do, exercises, but one of the fast ones is, and this is for everybody. So if there's a food that you don't, that you love or you really like, but you don't want to, it's just not good for you. And you truly don't, now this is the caveat. You truly don't want to like it anymore. So you think of the picture of that food and don't play around. So if you don't, if it's something that you do want to like, you know, don't follow me on this, but if it's something that you want to dislike and you don't want to like anymore, so imagine that picture. Now imagine that picture in black and white. Now imagine that picture like a fuzzy. Now imagine that picture far away from you. Make it go all the way from you, like the size of a postage stamp away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And for the bonus round, you could even imagine a stinky smell when you look at that picture.
Huh.
And then imagine the sound of Tupperware when it seals, like old Tupperware, if you remember that. Seal that picture. And obviously, in a group like this, you know, having a conversation that we're having, I'm not working with individual clients. That's the gist of it. When I work with a client one-on-one, obviously I'd be watching them. I'd be seeing how they respond to it. I would find out how their picture looks before that. But in general, in realities, that's a process that would help that way. And the same way with if you have like a negative memory. Now this one, I'm not going to talk about this one actually because this is best done with somebody. Like I told you, you know, you want to make sure that if things don't go according to plan that someone's there with you. But you know, if you have memories that you want to get rid of, definitely working with an NLP coach can help you with that. Something else I wanted to mention is that strategies, we talked about that with driving. So we all have strategies. We have a strategy for everything we do. Mm-hmm. Everything we do has a strategy. First I do this, then I do this, then I do this. You know, is it so, you know, first I see something or first I hear something or first I talk to myself and I hear self-talk. And by dealing with those strategies, one, we can get away, we could help you get away from bad habits. If you have something that you're doing that you don't want to do, what we can do is we can scramble that strategy that you currently have. It's a real fun exercise. It's funny and it's silly, but it really scrambles it. I had a client that he was having, and I'm trying to be very confidential but get my point across, he was having issues performing a certain task at work. And I worked with him, and I scrambled how he did it, his strategy to do it. And then I gave, and I worked with him to get a new strategy that would have a positive outcome. Mm-hmm. And he was able to do that job task fully. So it's pretty exciting, and it worked.
Yeah.
I also want to mention hypnosis. That's what I do. So the thing about hypnosis is that hypnosis itself is just a concentrated focus and trance. I talked to someone the other day, and this is something that I tell all my clients. Here's the secret. All hypnosis is self-hypnosis. If I tell you to relax the muscles of your eyes, relax them so much that you can't hold your eyes open, don't do that now, but I'm just saying if I was to say that, who has to relax their eyes?
Mm-hmm.
You do. I'm not relaxing my eyes. So, you know, if you don't want to be hypnotized, people's like, oh, you can't hypnotize me. I say, you're right. That's 100% correct.
Uh-huh.
Now, are you hypnotizable? Yes. The majority of people are. So, but then the thing I also want to mention about hypnosis is that the work takes place within that trance. So in that state of concentrated focus, because we all go into trance all the time. You have the TV watching trance if you watch TV. Have you ever been, you know, you've gone on a long road trip and maybe you're driving down the street and the telephone poles are just going by. You're on the freeway and it's dark and it's at night and you're by yourself and you got some light music playing on the radio and you just relaxed and you're watching those poles go by one after the other, after the other. And you miss your turn. You miss your exit because you weren't paying attention and you were in that driving trance. So it happens all the time. So, but the work then takes place within that trance. So once I do an induction and get a client into trance, then that's when the work takes place. That's when we do the work. So just a little bit about hypnosis there. It's great stuff. I love hypnotic language. I love how our minds work. And the last thing I wanted to mention, I want to leave us on a positive note here, is get out in nature. Get out in nature and enjoy nature. Besides just being good to get out and enjoy and be connected to nature, it actually finds that being connected to nature is associated with lower levels of poor mental health and lower levels of depression and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Scientifically proven through studies. A lot of studies going on about it right now. Being in nature can generate a multitude of positive emotions, such as calmness, joy, creativity, and facilitate concentration. That sounds like where I want to be, right?
Yes. Very nice.
there's a term called biophilia, and what that is the human tendency to interact or be closely associated with other forms of life or in nature. A desire or tendency to commune with nature. So it's just built into us. It's very, you know, connecting back to nature is into us. And the good news is that even if you don't have access to outdoor spaces or you can't see outside nature from your, like, your work environment, they have found that exposure to nature and even by video leads to improvements in attention, positive emotions, and the ability to reflect on a life problem. So just watching a video of nature or looking at photos of nature helps. It's not as great as actually being in nature, but it helps. So that's exciting for, like, if you live in an urban environment where you can't get out and about. I try to take a walk every day. I work from home now, and I try to take a walk every day just to get in nature, just to get, you know, get some breath and stretch my legs. And it's amazing. Like, if I'm not really sure about what I'm going to do that day and kind of where I'm at, if I don't have clients, take that walk, and I come back and I'm energized and I'm relaxed and I'm ready to tackle my day.
Yeah, that's very true. Okay, so Jason, just to interrupt you a second, I want to make sure that everyone hears this, but how do people reach you if somebody wants to talk to you further about something you've discussed tonight?
Thank you. I appreciate that. So you could either just email me direct at onepathcoaching, all one word, onepathcoaching@gmail.com. Or you can go to my website, www.onepathcoaching.com.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now go on and tell us some other interesting or fun stories about people.
So one other thing about nature, that studies have shown that if you're going to nature or watch a video of nature for as little as 5 minutes prior to going into a stressful situation, then your emotional recovery time, your ability to so-called bounce back after the event will be a lot quicker. So some great stuff. Also, I wanted to mention two amazing people that do great work and are just great people, Lee Lesser and Chris Fortin. They were the ones that originally designed and started, at the time it was called Honoring the Path of the Warrior, and then they changed the name to Veterans Path. And they work with veterans, and they've since stepped back. They're still connected to it, but another group has taken over, and to continue that message getting further, because it was a Bay Area only organization, and now it's gone national. Still a great organization doing great things. But it's using mindfulness and meditation with veterans. And part of that is also, oddly enough, is going into nature. So we would start with a little talk, a meditation. We would go do an outside event, and then we would come back and end the day with like a little meditation and exercise. And me personally, the results I saw with myself was great. You know, I started with that organization to give back and to help out my fellow veterans. And I got there and I was like, wow, I need this too. Turns out I got some stuff going on. So two amazing people. They met at the San Francisco Zen Center. Chris is a Zen monk, I believe it's called. So anyway, so I wanted to shout out to them, that organization doing great work. I also wanted to mention that if you're anywhere close to Winters, California, myself and another local, some of them was a business here, Kimberly Unger, on June 12th, we're doing a focus workshop. We're going to do a little talk and a meditation, and then Kimberly's going to do a yoga class, and then we're going to end up with another meditation. And so that's in Winters on June 12th from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. Just going to be 12 people. It's going to be a smaller class. And if they're in the area and they want to join, Kimberly's website is Kimberly Unger, so KimberlyUnger, healingarts.com, and you can get tickets on there. And I'm excited, you know, give back to the community, work with someone else doing great work, helping people with the mind-body connection, and that's what it's all about. And throughout this work, hopefully I gave you some good insight and some ideas about how to process that stress and anxiety and to make your life a little bit better and process these things.
Very nice, Jason. Yeah, you've told me a lot of things about dealing with the daily stress and anxiety that just always seems to be there. And it's important to we have to live through that and with it and among it in our daily lives. And it's wonderful to hear that, we can do that. There is a way.
Yeah, and it's not the event. Exactly. It's not the event. It's how we respond to the event, right?
Yes. Yeah, my husband is a Buddhist, and he's always telling me that.
Oh,
I'm like, yeah, maybe that's true, but...
Exactly. Like I said, you know, and I believe in that as well. And this, you know, but we have to live on these lives. And just by starting by breathing and getting, you know, you can do meditation. There's a lot of great stuff that we can do out there. And just taking that first step, acknowledge, you know what, I don't want this stress and I don't want this anxiety anymore. Just starting off there, it's a great place to start.
Yes. That's very, very good advice. Yes. So you are your tour guide for happiness, for living a good, satisfying life. Yeah, because that's what we all need to do. We need more of it around us.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you very much for your help in this matter.
Yep, and thank you for inviting me on. I really appreciate it. And all respect to you. You're doing great things.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you. We appreciate hearing from you tonight, Jason. So as long as no one has anything to say, then people can get in touch with you privately. Thank you very much, Jason, and good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.